Hello and welcome back to The Sound of Economics. I'm Nicholas Barrett.
And I'm Guntram Wolf.
And today we'll be discussing weaponized independence, how global economic networks shape state coercion. When joined by two very special guests, author of the paper I just named, we have Henry Farwell from George Washington University. Hi, Henry.
Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. And we have Abraham L. Newman from Georgetown University.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, weaponized independence, it's the idea that the global economy might not be exactly what we think it is or hope it to be. It's not something that's really guided or shaped by invisible hands, but something that's coerced by quite visible hands and maybe even a few iron fists. Could you explain?
So the idea behind weaponized interdependence is that we have a world in which global networks, which used to be the kinds of things that connected the world together, that made this international economy, that brought these different markets together into peaceful and happy commercial communion, suddenly have become tools of economic coercion, so that states are able to seize upon central aspects of these networks and then use these networks to cut other adversaries, whether they be individuals or businesses or states, out of the global economy, that they're able to use these for vast surveillance systems and in general to turn what seemed to be a very, very nice world of globalization and so on into something which is much more about coercion.
So, Abraham, the idea is that certain elements of the economy have become incredibly centralized, and by seizing those nodes, you can exert great influence over entire countries and entire industries. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, you have this view, this Thomas Friedman view of the world, that the whole thing was flat, that whether it was the internet, production networks, finance, that they were all very complicated and very decentralized. And one of the things that we identify in the paper is that across these global economic networks, there are often points of centralization. So think Google's Android operating system or the Swift financial messaging system or fiber optic cables that are used for the internet. All those things centralize the system, and then states have woken up to this fact. And they realize that those central points of communication, production, and finance are an opportunity for them for control.
So, Guntram, in terms of what we understand about economists, have basically seen the world as a series of kind of transactions of rational actors and so on. And has the field perhaps been a bit naive about the state of global politics and how depoliticized economics or politicized economics actually is?
Well, I think what I find very fascinating when talking with international relations people is the completely different approach that international relations people have to economists. I mean, for an economist, the world is lots of win-win. So you gain, I gain, because, you know, I can do more business with you. It's good. If you are richer, I can do more business with you. Well, international relations people tend to think of a world as a zero sum. You gain, I lose, right? Because you're stronger, I'm less strong. And I think what we've learned in the last couple of years is in fact that the EU traditionally has focused way too much on, let's say, the economic logic, the win-win, and hasn't understood that there are some actors out there that try to weaponize economics to achieve geopolitical goals. And a lot of thinking now in Brussels and also in the economics professions is about, well, I mean, how do we think these things together? And so in that sense, yes, I would say the EU perhaps, not economists, let's say the EU, I think, was perhaps too naive in its approach to foreign relations, international, the role of the EU in the world.
Henry, how did you arrive at this perception? Did you have some kind? Was there an event that triggered it? Did you have some kind of epiphany? How did you come to see the world like this?
Well, we were always interested in these questions of coercion because, indeed, international relations professors do tend to be much, much more interested in power relations and bargaining between unequal actors and those kinds of things. But I think we began to wake up. We had been interested in the SWIFT network because we had done work on Europe-US fights over privacy, and SWIFT played an important role in that story. And so that sensitized us to the way in which SWIFT was being used to achieve all of these effects against Iran. And then we began to start thinking that this was a more general logic, that there was a lot of stuff happening which really was falling between the cracks because economists didn't tend to study this for the reasons that have just been outlined, whereas political scientists, international relations scholars, usually thought about these systems as being very, very technical, very detailed and extremely boring, and didn't actually understand that there was a real politics that was happening there. And so we started to try and unravel this, to start thinking about where the politics were, how it worked, what were the mechanisms, and that's how we came up with this.
Yeah, I just want to add that I think something that's interesting to this argument is that it pushes what I would think of as a you can win and lose at the same time. Mm. And so in a traditional kind of zero-sum mentality, some actors are losing when the others are winning. But in our world, the economic actors are winning. They're making money hand over fist. But at the same time, the governments, the states, have new coercive power. And so that's what makes this so challenging and also interesting, is that you can have an economic logic that can produce these networks and network effects where actors want to continue the efficiency gains and rents that they're getting from them, but then it exposes states to new power relations.
Well, Abram, can you enlarge a little bit more on this point of the network and how the network really emerges? Because, I mean, in a sense, we used to think of the internet as the perfect democratic tool, right? I mean, it was a perfect network which is symmetric, everybody has access to it, everybody can upload his stuff, so there is no power relation in the internet. It's the basic democratic idea. That was an idea that was for a very long time entertained by many people on the left, on the right, that were really seeking almost salvation in the internet, I have to say. And in a sense, what you're saying, and I think what most people now have understood, is that the internet itself creates lots of power structures around certain firms, around networks, around nodes, central nodes. And your starting point in the paper is really that this is the core vulnerability also for the state. So it's a perhaps a private sector driven vulnerability, but it creates a vulnerability for citizens in the entire country. So can you enlarge a little bit on this network idea?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a bunch of drivers that can create centralization within networks, and we talk about these in the paper. Sometimes it's about simple efficiency. So in the case of the internet, you need very large transmission capabilities, and so it's often fiber optic cables. And you know what? You don't want to lay a million fiber optic cables. It's more effective to just have a few, and that creates a centralization in the network. But in other areas, it's much more about rent seeking. So, you know, big companies like Facebook, they like to control the central node because they get to charge rents for that sitting on that core economic activity. And so you can have multiple paths to that centralization, either kind of a market path where companies are creating that centralization for their own benefit, or it can just be simply about efficiency gains.
Something that maybe should be added here, and this is not something we talk about in the paper, but we talk about in other work, is that there always has been a scarce commodity on the internet, which has been attention. You know, so if you have so many voices, then that means that attention becomes the scarce resource. It becomes the thing that everybody is struggling in order to try and get. Indeed, by podcasts being one important way of doing this. But you also see how it is, and this is the second phase of this, that too can be weaponized. So if we look at the various kinds of attacks that have been made by Russian influence agents and so on, trying to increase disagreement and whatever, a lot of these attacks are based upon what the political scientist Margaret Roberts calls flooding, which is to say that it's not so much intended to convince people of this, that, or the other thing, but instead to flood the zone with so many contrary opinions, beliefs, disbeliefs, arguments, and nonsense that it becomes completely impossible to figure out what is true anymore. So in a sense, what we see here is, you know, so first of all, we saw an economy which was all based around trying to get attention. You know, so if you had various algorithms from Facebook and whatever, which are all about maximizing the degree of quote engagement, unquote, which you get. And then you begin to see political actors realize that there are benefits that you can get from this if you're an autocracy. You can use this to divide potential democratic opponents or other opponents of the regimes, and then people begin to stumble into using this against democratic systems as well.
So it seems to be a kind of almost to some extent, at least in the economic aspect of this argument, it seems to be kind of a, at least that kind of supports the Trumpian worldview that anybody who saw global free trade as truly free was quite naive, and that it was never that free and there were always state powers strongly coercing the market and leaning it in certain directions. And I suppose that's always been true if you look back through history. You know, Napoleon invaded Russia to stop Russia trading with England. And the difference now is that the world is just so much more connected than ever. So is there a kind of intellectual defense for the kind of strong trading tactics we're seeing emerging now in the world?
Not really, or not to that extent. So what I would say is that to get back to the zero-sum versus win-win, there's a whole range of possibilities in the middle. You know, so if you think about game theorists, they talk about bargaining games, mixed motive games in which effectively there is a win-win solution, but there are a variety of different win-win solutions. And some of them I win more, and in some of them you win more. And this is the standard way in which bargaining takes place in the international arena, that you have power dynamics and power asymmetries, but everybody ends up more or less better off. And I think that what the Trumpian way of thinking about the world does is it says, well, we're in this world where there are the powerful, there are the elite, and there are the non-elite. The elite have been making your lives miserable for decades. I am going to help you get these guys. But effectively, what that means is I am going to become the elite, and I am going to get whatever I get out of this. And what you will get is a satisfaction of seeing these people who you have hated being humiliated and being flustered and not knowing what to do. But part of what Abe and I are trying to do with our work, and this is a piece that is coming out in Foreign Affairs in the next week or 2 weeks, is to try and argue back against those kinds of zero-sum kinds of ways of thinking about the world, and to say we don't want to immediately be catapulted from this kind of illusion of a win-win world into a world in which we can see the only politics being dog-eat-dog politics, in which the best thing that you can possibly do is to remove yourself from the global economy. Instead, we want to start thinking more systematically about ways in which you can try to preserve as much as you can of what is good about the global system, which we need, especially in the world of global warming and other collective threats, to try and build as much as possible while recognizing that there are real security vulnerabilities and start talking about how those security vulnerabilities could be mitigated.
Can we talk a bit about SWIFT, so the financial network that spans the world and where basically all global financial transactions between banks and financial firms are being sent through, the information about these financial transactions are being sent through a SWIFT network, which is located here in Belgium, very close to Brussels, in fact, and which is supervised by Belgian authorities, yet still it is a network where the central node seems to be influenced or even controlled by the United States. Can you just walk us through why that is the case and what's the argument in your paper?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I want to stress is that this didn't start with Trump. It wasn't a Trump phenomenon, but it really goes back to the post 9/11 experience. The United States was panicked about how to respond in a world where globalization could be turned against the United States, you know, planes flying into the World Trade Center. And what basically every bureaucracy was tasked with, what can they do to solve this problem? And that's where SWIFT lights went on, particularly in the Treasury. They started to realize that SWIFT was a treasure trove of information about adversaries, both terrorists, but also rogue states. And the interesting thing was that in that period, when the United States really went hard after SWIFT, it did it also in cooperation with the Europeans. And so it was a period of what I would call diplomatic weaponized interdependence. It was a period where the United States pressed as far as it could go, and it often asked for help from its allies. And in that period, you know, when the SWIFT was used in order to put pressure on Iran, it was the Europeans that actually disconnected Iran from the SWIFT system through legislation, European legislation. What we're seeing now is the fact that the United States doesn't necessarily need the European Union to do it. And there the channel is really about the importance of the global, of the US dollar to the global financial system, and SWIFT realizing that it could run reputational risks if it would not comply with U.S. demands. And that's, I think, what's driving so much friction with the Europeans, is that they realize that they do not need to be a partner in this, and that the United States can go ahead unilaterally with this kind of pressure.
Can you explain reputational risk? What exactly is that? I mean, so what would be the risk to SWIFT, really? I mean, is it more the reputational risk for the people sitting on the board and the executives at SWIFT, that they next time they take a flight to New York, they will be just put into prison? Or what's really the risk here?
I mean, This is the world of what I would call compliance panic. You know, it's a few key banks get targeted by the U.S. sanctions authorities, OFAC, BNP Paribas, for example, you know, faces a huge fine. And then all of a sudden, the entire financial community wakes up and says, you know, what are we willing to risk to do this? And the thing about SWIFT is that many of the board members are actually U.S. citizens. And so that immediately puts SWIFT in the compliance zone, because they're not just European citizens, they're also U.S. citizens. And so in that sense, there's a legal conundrum that SWIFT faces about what would happen if they weren't to comply with U.S. Orders.
I was just thinking, there is an argument that a lot of the growth in the United States prior to the collapse of Lehman Brothers, well, there's an argument that a lot of that was due to a massive exercise of state power on the other side of the world when the Chinese government saw the Asian crisis with the IMF. And they decided that that would never happen to them. So they deliberately devalued their own economy, their own currency, sorry. And then they lent huge sums of money to the Americans. And instead of investing it in their population, it means they could flood the American market with cheap goods. And then instead of investing the money in their own population, they lent it to America, which meant that America was in debt back to them. Both countries had huge economic growth, and you had a win-win situation caused by a massive exercise of state power, which I find quite interesting. And it could be that it's just maybe us, maybe just Western economists were the last people in the world to believe that we existed in a purely rational economic multilateral system.
Well, I would just say that I think even in the United States vis-a-vis China, there was this mentality that we should do constructive engagement, that we should have an open door policy, that the way to reform China was through economic openness. And it's really, I think, very quickly shifted. And you see these strategies that we've talked about, weaponized interdependence, being used against China. So particularly in the 5G setting, over telecommunications infrastructures, the United States has initiated a whole bunch of export controls to limit China's access to key global inputs into the Chinese company Huawei supply chain.
But Henry, can I ask you on that point? I mean, so your paper was, in a sense, was written probably before the major escalation between the U.S. and China, technology war, trade war, whatever you want to call it. But it probably got a lot of traction because of the China issue becoming so big. So can you just sort of walk us a bit more through the argument of China? I mean, China in a sense is so central to these networks, and in many respects really also creates its own networks. And how is that going to play out with China, really? I mean, can we really think of a world where we separate the networks between China and the US, and everybody has to opt in either on one side or the other side? Is that the kind of world we are driving at?
Maybe. Well, I think, as you say, China is very, our paper has gotten, I think, a quite far, far more take-up than we ever expected to get. And that has been because of, I think, what has been happening in China. We wrote this paper. We started thinking about this stuff before the China thing blew up. But then it provides a simple and straightforward way of thinking about some of the relationships and some of the problems that are emerging. But in response to the specific question, I think that the interesting question for China is, if you really want to be able to build these networks on a global level, you probably want to appear to be somewhat trustworthy to other actors. You want to be able to appear as if you're not going to use these things against them. And of course, this is a problem for the United States too, especially as it increasingly begins to look like an untrustworthy actor in its unilateral use of these things to its allies. It may be that this has consequences for take up, but I think China's real problem is that it's very difficult for it to credibly commit in the future, especially given the lack of internal controls on its regime. It's going to be very difficult for it to credibly commit to create a small L liberal network, and especially after what's happened in Hong Kong, where effectively you saw China having maintained this island's jurisdiction close by it, which was supposed to be insulated to some extent from the mainland's political and legal systems so that money could be held in held safely. And now you're seeing how the Hong Kong legal system is taking a beating as a result of the continued demonstrations and China's efforts to try and push back against that. So I think what China is going to do, and what China certainly has been doing, is it has been trying to create these kinds of networks, and it has tried to work together with Russia, for example, in trying to create alternatives to SWIFT. It may be able to get some traction for that, but I suspect that for a lot of states, they're going to look at this and they're going to decide that they are between the devil and the deep blue sea, and they would prefer to try and swim in the deep blue sea of the United States-dominated networks rather than expose themselves to a new source of risk. And so what China is going to continue to do is more or less what it's doing right now, which is to leverage access to its market as a means of punishing other countries. So this is very different from what we talk about. This is not leveraging global networks. This is because China has such a big domestic market. It is able to do bad things to companies which incur its displeasure. And that is going to be the leverage that it is going to use, which is similar to, but actually much more traditional and quite distinct from the kinds of networked phenomena that we talk about in the paper.
So an opportunity for the European Union. So China not really having credibility, the US perhaps losing credibility. Is that the moment for Europe to create the global currency, global payment systems, and become a true actor?
I've wondered about that, you know, that there might be this kind of the European Union could turn its reputation for a real commitment to multilateralism, could turn that into a strength and a source of credibility. But of course, there are a whole bunch of other political conditions which the European Union would have to fulfill internally with regard to bumping up its fiscal capacity, with regard to increasing its willingness to offer swap lines to other countries. A lot of other things would have to happen.
I would just say for any of these areas to really function the way Henry and I talk about them, you need two things. You need both the private actor network, and then you also need the state to have the institutional capacity to activate or protect, defend these types of network hubs. And so if you think about different global emerging economic networks that have this network effect, Europe is often behind the curve. So if you think about AI, in the realm of AI, the problem is that Europe doesn't really have the access to the private actor networks that it might want. And in the area of finance, you know, it lacks the institutions to leverage global finance in the way that it might want to.
And it's getting rid of London, the city of London, which from our perspective, that has consequences.
Mm. And if you are a Western policymaker and you're reading this paper and you're encountering this kind of new sobriety, how can you deploy it? What's your reaction supposed to be? Because you obviously you're encountering a lot of incentives to maybe not be so open and to perhaps fear the consequences of openness, but you also kind of rely on the growth that comes with it.
Well, I think my first takeaway would be don't panic. You know, our whole point is not to freak out. In fact, there aren't that many sectors of the economy that have this network topology where you just have one key hub or two key hubs. And so policymakers should focus and think about where is global economic interactions working in a much more traditional way, the way that Henry talked about, where really the threat is maybe market access restrictions, but not about this control over global economic networks. And then the second point is then how do you address these areas where you do have centralization in the networks? And there, I think our takeaway, what we want to argue is that you shouldn't retreat into some kind of, devil with the details decoupling. You need to really think about how do you build in redundancies, limit your exposure, do things to reduce your vulnerability and not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
But the centralization, in your view, is inevitable. It's an inevitable side effect of globalization. That's always going to happen.
Well, I think, you know, if you take a lot of different markets, you can see places where it's not centralized or it doesn't have to be centralized. If you take 5G, there are European firms that can provide 5G technology. So the Europeans would, you know, be better off if they didn't just rely solely on Huawei technology, but they built in systems that had both Nokia, Ericsson, and Huawei technology. But by going solely or primarily with Huawei, they then build in that network centrality, which then opens up a new security vulnerability.
Should the Europeans seize the nodes of production and say, you know what, if you want to take part in our economy, you have to decarbonize and you have to protect your rainforests? could it be used for good?
It could be. And that's and I think one of the other interesting questions is if we saw, for example, a Warren administration or Sanders administration or maybe even a Buttigieg administration, although there I think would be a little less likely, you could see some efforts to deliberately start to construct and to use these things as means of external coercion to try and push back against some of the ways in which states are not decarbonizing in the way that they ought to. Obviously, there is a debate which is happening in Europe around border taxes and trying to use border taxes, which is, again, a more traditional route towards the same thing. And the other way in which I could see this perhaps being used, especially if we saw Warren getting in, would be to try and push back against global tax havens, because here we've seen in the past very, very effective use of somewhat similar techniques against Swiss banking secrecy. And so you could see if there was an administration like the Warren administration, which was really energized and which was able to get this stuff through administratively, you could see perhaps them using some of these tools in combination with the more traditional tools of the Internal Revenue Service, and perhaps looking to work together with Germany and other such places that are also worried about the risks of tax flight.
That sounds like something that could be quite popular. Well, Henry Fowle, Abraham L. Newman, thank you very much for joining us. It's been great having you. I found it fascinating. If people want to read the paper, where do they go? MIT Journal website?
The MIT Journal International Security is where they need to go to. There is a draft version of the paper which gives most of the arguments on my website, henryfowle.net. And Abe, do you have another copy of it somewhere?
I think you're our draft copy holder.
Okay.
And it comes with the Guntram Wolf seal of approval.
Yes.
Right.
Thanks again for the conversation.
Thanks a lot for both of you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening. Bye.